From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. John Cale may have influenced your record collection a whole lot more than you'd ever imagine. Start with his early days, when the Welsh viola player was in the seminal band The Velvet Underground. And when Cale left that band in 1968, he went on to produce or to play on some of the most important records in rock music, records that still shape what many of us still hear today. The first Stooges record, he played with the British unknown, now folk icon Nick Drake. He played with contemporary minimalist Terry Riley. John Cale produced the first Modern Lovers record, the first Patti Smith record, both really important records in the blossoming days of new music in the middle and late 1970s. His own solo records in the early 1970s were brilliant. Fear, Slow Dazzle, Paris 1919. If you haven't heard any of them, go back and listen to them. His cover of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah was one of the first covers to put that song in the canon of pop tunes, and it would be the model for Jeff Buckley's version of Hallelujah. I'm not sure what John Cale thinks about his collaboration with Brian Eno for one of Eno's last vocal records, but Wrong Way Up is one of my favorite records of the 1990s, as is Songs for Drella, a collaboration with his former bandmate Lou Reed, and their look back at the life of their producer and mentor of sorts, Andy Warhol. I could go on, but suffice it to say that John Cale continues to surprise me, even at age 71. And his new album, Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood, that's just come out, is honestly one of his best. We asked John Cale to play DJ for us on this edition of All Songs Considered. He was in the studio in New York City while I was here in Washington, D.C. I asked him about some of the first music that made a mark on him.
Well, there was this program that I used to get on shortwave radio in Wales called Willis Conover on Voice of America, and he used to have a jazz program on a Sunday, and that was where I really came across a lot of the styles of jazz playing that were around. I was chasing kind of classical music, but jazz was trying to I was trying to figure out how this worked. And one of the times he played some Miles Davis music, and that was kind of a minimalist and a very different style. You know, he'd play Duke Ellington usually and some classics. So when I got some money, I went out and I went looking for some jazz, and I found a Miles Davis EP that was there called Kind of Blue. I didn't understand what improvisation was at that point, and I was trying to figure it out. And
how old were you?
I must be 14 or 15.
Mm-hmm. That's a good age.
And because I was jealous of that style of music, because there's a lot of freedom. And I didn't understand what the rules were. And really, everybody I asked, they said there aren't no rules, which is the worst kind of answer you want.
Let's hear just a little bit. People might not have context. What song you want to play off Kind of Blue?
Freddie Freeloader.
Great. For a lot of people, John Cale, music when you're 14, 15, 16, 17 has more heft. Maybe it has, maybe it's more aggressive. Maybe that just wasn't it for your time. We're talking the late 50s here.
Well, some of the things I got from Voice of America, you know, had influence. One of the things that he played one Sunday was The Four Freshmen, and they sang a version of What's It Like in Glockamora. And I listened to these harmonies, and, you know, they went through every key in the universe, perfectly modulated, and it's beautiful. That kind of was what I remembered when I heard the Beach Boys in my room. I mean, the style of the Beach Boys, and Brian talks about it, how the Four Freshmen, how he appreciated them, but Beach Boys really had that harmony that it's kind of religious in a way. Mm-hmm. And certainly in Wales, I mean, there's a lot of that going on.
And for you, at this point, are you playing at all? Because you're talking here about being attracted to keys. You're talking about being attracted to harmony. Is it simply visceral and audio, or is it something because you're studying music, you're finding fascination in it?
Well, yeah, all of that confusion. Okay. Yeah, and trying to figure out which way is this going to turn out, and what part does improvisation have in classical music, which is basically none. I mean, you have cadenzas, but I was trying to figure out why I guess I didn't like classical music that much. I mean, I was interested in avant-garde and stuff like that.
What were you playing at that point?
That viola and keyboards.
Mm-hmm. And so were you're learning classics as part of either quartets or
yeah,
small
yeah.
ensembles and school stuff?
Yeah, I'm trying to play, you know, the literature was small for viola, so you did the Walton Concerto or whatever that was available, the Bartok one, and then you ended up torturing yourself trying to play Paganini.
And then you hear something like, why don't I just play it, play in my room.
There's a world where I can go and tell my secrets to.
It's only 2 minutes and 14 seconds. I kind of feel like playing the whole thing, but it's hard to make that stop, right? Does it still get you? I mean, all these...
Yeah,
there's... 50 years later, good Lord, 50 years.
Yeah,
later.
Yeah. No, I mean, I didn't go to the Beach Boys reunion at Hollywood Bowl. I didn't... If they were going to do in my room there, I just... I'd rather remember it as it was.
You know, I saw this tour, and I was honestly, I was scared to see it, maybe same apprehension, and I have to say, it was beautiful. I mean, it took 9 people to do what 4 or 5 did, but they did it justice. They really did do it justice. They really have these, you know, these understudies in many ways, these people who love them so much, who... You know, kind of sit just below what the Beach Boys, quote unquote, the remaining ones there, and they sound gorgeous. Still,
yeah, I don't know why it ground to a halt.
Well, people are people.
Yeah.
I'd like to play something of yours, and maybe talk about making music, figuring out some of these little puzzle pieces, the harmony, and then. What sort of in Some of Kind of Blue is a very modal music. Maybe we can talk about that. Maybe there's some of that in the song I'm going to play. I'm going to play Face to the Sky.
Yeah.
Which is off a new record people may not know yet called Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood. Comes out October 2nd here in the States. Let's play a little Face to the Sky and talk about it a bit.
Listening to the wind.
There's an awful lot of stuff going on here. Can we talk about how you built this song, put it together? Start with the bottom, yeah. Start with the beat. Where's that coming
yeah,
from?
Yeah, the beat was, well, I just sat around with an MPC and
an MPC is a...
is one of these electronic drums, and it has certain things that I like about electronic drums, which is a swing button. And I'm kind of addicted to the swing button because it gives you that lazy backbeat and it takes the rigidity out of it a little bit.
Right.
So it started there then.
You said we, first of all. So who's the we in this?
Oh, we're in the studio, myself and then my engineer. It takes a little while to figure out where you're going with the song. And you leave it for a day, you come back the next day and you say, okay, move this from here to there. And then move that from here to over to another place. And then you listen to that for a while and maybe there's an idea, you put a vocal down. And then you come back the next day and you change the vocal around, you move the other parts around. It's a bit of a jigsaw, but you're trying to drive the song forward at each step. And you're trying to hear, will you arrive at a chorus or not? Will you have a bridge or not? And I don't care about whether I arrive at them or not. It's just if the final thing, and that's kind of what I like about the song, is that it doesn't really have a chorus and it doesn't really have a bridge. It's sort of an amorphous piece that sits there, but it makes sense.
Is it in some ways the same as when you listen to a modal piece, a piece of music that sort of stays in the same place and has some underpinning that pulls it together, but doesn't have the normal chord changes that a singer-songwriter or something would have? Is that an attraction for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's if I can do that with all the contemporary noise that's available, then I'm happy. I mean,
and all of the contemporary noise.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
There really is.
But I think a lot of the tracks on the album have the same characteristic. You know, I use spoken word, Vietnamese, and all that in different songs. So.
We'll play another song soon out of it. I'd like to go and maybe talk about some of the stuff that, as you grew up and as you are an adult these days, so maybe something from the 21st century that you enjoy.
Well, there's one artist that I've really of the hip hop genre, Snoop and Pharrell. That song, "Drop It Like It's Hot," that's kind of was a shock to me when I heard it because it was so original. And when things like that, the same thing happened when I heard Beck doing "I'm a Loser," it just sort of like stood on its own, and you really don't know where it came from. It doesn't fit in anywhere, and for me anyway, I just immediately get envious. How did they do this? How did this? And I try and figure out how they put the pieces together. I still haven't figured it out with Beck, although I've heard a lot of people tell me how the production happened. But I've not spoken to Pharrell. I don't know how they work. But the originality of it was staggering.
We'll play it in a second. With sort of sparseness, maybe? Is that
totally.
The, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, this "Drop It" is like just slamming.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just basic, you know, hardcore rhythm.
Pimps in the crib, ma. Drop it like it's hot. Drop it like it's hot. Drop it like it's hot. When the pigs try to get at you, park it like it's hot. Park it like it's hot. Park it like it's hot. And if a nigga get an attitude, pop it like it's hot. Pop it like it's hot. Pop it like it's hot. I got the rollie on my arm and I'm pouring Chandon and I'm all the best weed cause I got it going on.
I'm a nice dude with some nice dreams. See these ice cubes, see these ice creams. Eligible bachelor, $1 million bow. That's whiter than what's spilling down your throat. The phantom, exterior like fish eggs. The interior like suicide wrist red. I can exercise you, this could be your phys ed. Cheat on your man, man, that's how you get a his ed. Killer with the B, I know killers in the street. With the steel to make you feel like chinchilla in the heat. So don't try to run up on my ear talking all that raspy shit. Trying to ask me shit. When my niggas feel your vest, they ain't gon' pass me shit. You should think about it, take a second. Matter of fact, you should
4B and think before you fuck a little skateboard B.
Snoop Dogg and Pharrell Williams, you said to me you were surprised when you heard this. You're surprised, obviously we talked about the minimalism in it, but where were you and when you heard this, and do you remember?
No, that's a good question. I think I just got home from the studio, and a friend of mine who had been in the studio told me, you got to hear this. I found it, and I listened to it, and all of a sudden, this thing isn't in any key. And it's cute, and it's cheeky, but it's got this atmosphere. It's got nothing in it, basically. It's really just rhythm, but it performs perfectly. And for somebody who didn't know that much about hip-hop at the time, that was a whole new world.
Talking 2004.
Yeah, and all of a sudden I started paying attention because there were different things going on there. And also the quality of the production that I was coming across on all the hip-hop records I was doing was much higher than there was in rock and roll.
Here's something that strikes me. You're talking about in this, your attraction to its sparseness. And when I think of you and the things that I grew up on that were yours, what I was attracted to in what you loved was exactly the opposite of that in many ways. I mean, okay, so it was minimal, but there was always something going on. And usually that something going on was a drone of some sort. And this is sort of absent of that.
Yeah, well, the drone is replaced with the rhythm, with the tongue clicking. I mean, these new sounds that they put together. What I realized when I heard this, and the thing that put me back on my heels, was that you don't need all that density that was going on in traditional rock and roll. Mm-hmm. You really just need a few things. And I've always admired, you know, that side of art that's gets you a lot done with very few resources.
Well, Nico and the Harmonium, maybe?
No. Yeah, that's driving a different truck. For sure. That was language as well. I mean, you know, Nico didn't speak English very well, but you know, Jim Morrison persuaded her that she was a poet, and off she went.
Let's play something off of Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood. I'm going to play the title track. It's called Nookie Wood.
Yeah.
And again, this is very beat-driven piece of music.
This is the one with the Vietnamese announced. It's trying to be Blade Runner.
Can you tell us, as people listen to it, what's being said?
In the Vietnamese?
Doesn't...
No.
Do you want...
No, I mean, it's just an announcer.
Yeah.
And I just took it from somewhere and used it. It's just general mayhem that you're trying to create of mm-hmm. people in the street or in a corridor or in a subway. That's where I saw the Blade Runner aspect of it.
Okay, let's hear it.
Uh-huh.
a really great record, John.
Thank you.
Yeah. You've been doing these things, these records, for so long. I don't know how many you've... Do you know how many you've put out? Over 25?
I wouldn't say 25. Okay. No, 90. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's a lot. Is there a character or something that you could use to describe this record that might set it off from things you've done before? Is there something you were going after that...
When you finish a record, you've written all these songs, and they're all about different things, and they all capture a different mood. And generally, this is what I go for when I write songs, is if I finish the song today, tomorrow I'll come in, and I'll go in the exact opposite place to start another song. So all of this is in flux. And then at the end, when you have the finished product with the choices that you made, then you look to see what it is that will capture the entity as such. So I didn't come up with a title. I picked one out of one of the songs, and it seemed to be the best way to wrap it all up. But I think there's a drive here that in the songwriting towards other things, because one of the strangest things that's happened is that there have been requests for B-sides. So when we finished with the record, we still had to go into the studio and write B-sides. And that's not something, you know, you don't want to go back to the old stuff. You try some new stuff. And the new stuff is more and more in the direction of Nookie Wood. It's more catastrophic. It's more bilingual. It's more fractured. But I'm still trying to lock into that bottom rhythm track that you get from hardcore machines that drive things. I mean,
have you ever thought of working with a hip hop producer that you admire?
I've thought about, of course. I mean, you know, on the other hand, the way I do things, I go in the studio and I write in on the studio. I don't write on a guitar or a piano and bring it in. And I really would like to find out how they do this. I mean, there are crews that come from Snoop, and you know, how do they get to that point? I think maybe it's just like the same way I come around to doing the songs, that the way I do is just sit there and think and try various things and see how they work. I heard that Dr. Dre works in the studio at 120 dB at all times. Wow. He doesn't play anything back below 120. And I got that from one of his engineers.
And that is loud.
Yeah, he was talking about how his job was to go in and fix fixtures in the studio, like the light fixtures and bits
so
of the board that were vibrating, that were rattling.
To me, it's kind of really odd to play music that loud, because so much music sounds really good loud. And to me, the trick is to make it at a level that, well, I don't know. I don't know about you, but I don't listen to music at 120 dB unless I'm at a club and I have no control over it. But that is loud.
Yeah, but I think it's also you want to put yourself in it.
I see.
I guess for him, it's the physical thing of having that 808 hit you in the chest. Or...
Yeah, that drum machine. So, You like, in some of the picks you've done, more traditional songs, song structure stuff as well. You want to play something for us?
Well, you mean The Harvest for the World, the Isley Brothers?
Yeah, you can do that. That'd be good.
That's a really nice song. Nobody pays attention to it. It's really a great song. I like the cover.
What was the cover? Wasn't it just them all in? Was a black cover with them in sort of shadow?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, let's play the title track, Harvest for the World.
Together, everyone a scene.
When hand claps were hand claps.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, handcuffs. No rhythm machines. No. Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, and they had, I don't know. I have to say this. I have to say that there isn't a chance in hell that I ever would have guessed that you would have picked that song.
No, but it's really good. Because I was chasing around looking for where to get a good tambourine-style song for the album. Because I was trying to get this Motown thing done, which eventually I found with Brian Burton. But
you did a collaboration with him on this record. Is it the opening cut? I want to talk to you. Is that the one?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So I was chasing around and I came across it and I put this aside. I thought the voice is just extraordinary.
Yeah.
But it's real. You know, I think there's a hi-hat going all the way through it, which may be a rhythm machine, but that's about it as far as drums.
Did you sit with Brian Burton, Danger Mouse, and spin records together when you worked together?
No, I was trying to talk to him about what I was looking for at the time, and we were going through a host of stuff because we were comparing notes about hip-hop and all of that, and he had Danger Doom, and I never heard the Grey album, and I didn't know Danger Doom. Mm-hmm. So he sent me a ton of stuff that really was Danger Doom stuff. And then I realized that this guy is really ferociously active. I mean, he's yeah. he's like working all the time. And I love that. And, you know, it's only a matter of time when you do stuff like that that you end up with the hits.
You're no slouch.
No. I mean, I love the Norah Jones album. There's some really interesting things on there.
I don't know if you heard me, but I said you're no slouch.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm a workaholic.
Yeah,
so.
Catherine, that is good. Can I go? I want to go back to some music that we haven't played that for so many people meant so much, and I'm going to play something where you're playing viola on. I got two choices here. Can do either Black Angel Death Song or Venus and Furs.
The Black Angel.
Yeah. Good.
The choice of his fate set themselves out upon a platform to choose. What had he to lose? Not a ghost bloody country all covered with sleep, where the black angel did weep. Not an old city street in the east. Gone to choose. And Warren Ring's brother walked on through the night with his hair and his face long, long splinted cut from the knife. The rally man's patter ran on through the dawn until we said so long to his skull. Shrill yell. Shining brightly red ribbon.
Nobody was doing anything like this. I mean, like you say, you heard something, you know, 2004, and you said, I had never heard anything like this. You know, in 1967, I guess I first heard this. Never heard anything like this. It was startling. The use of sound and what was going on.
Yeah, but the big difference was that nobody wanted to hear what this was doing. But I was with Snoop.
Yeah, well, there was that.
Yeah, I mean,
there are a couple of us out there.
Yeah. No, when the album came out, yeah.
I'm talking about when you were making it. Yeah,
when we got in gigs and all of that. They didn't want to hear this in the gigs.
Yeah. You mean, but there was stuff you were doing that they wanted to hear? Was it the more drum-based guitar, or they didn't want to hear any of it?
Well, anywhere, Café Roi, or anywhere in New York at the time, you play at least five numbers from the hit parade, or you don't get you don't get the job. And we didn't do any of it. And so they went, you know, they said, what's that song you just played? It's Black Angels. You play that again and you're fired. So Lou said, let's play it again.
We've had this conversation a number of times, the show we do, All Songs Considered Here, where I talk to people about the idea that, you know, for me, in the late 70s, how it was that unless you were pretty much a cover band, that's what you were doing. There weren't bands you could go to and see shows of playing the original music all that much until the middle 70s. I mean, and you're talking middle 60s.
That was kind of the scene. I mean, radio stations would invite somebody with a hit to appear at a high school auditorium, and then we got a gig there. And, you know, I think it was, who was this? Shirley Lewis? Is that her name? The banana song?
Oh, Sherry. Banana Faux Fan.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
She had the hit, and we opened for her. And, you know, DJ said, we'd like to introduce a new band. I think they've got something, and I hope it's not catching.
Yeah, so. God. Little did they know what you would do with that banana.
Yeah.
My gosh. Could you just talk a little bit about that, the song making process though, on actually let me do this. There's a version of the Velvet Underground and Nico record, which that comes from, coming out. I don't even know if you've spent as much time with this record as there is on this. It's like five discs. It has to be hours and hours. And I just recently got a download of it and started just scooting on through it. I'm going to play a little bit of it, of this song. It's called Melody Laughter. And I don't know if you've heard this in, you know, 40 years.
Isn't it Nico?
I don't know what it is. I'm going to play it. We'll see if it goes anywhere, fine. If it doesn't, I'll take it out. But yeah. I'm just going to play a little of this. And I'm going to ask Robin Hilton, who's got the computer, just to skip little moments. This thing's 28 minutes long, right? Right.
That's quality feedback.
We're 6 minutes in, I think.
Wow.
So you haven't heard this stuff in a
while.
Yeah. Go a little more, Robin. Do you remember these moments? Do you remember where you are and talk about some of this?
I kind of. I think it was all part of the Nico album, of her first one, Sunday, where she sang pretty songs, and there was one piece that we were invited in to play along with, and I think that's what it was. But you know, I'm not really that dependable.
But just describe the atmosphere. What kind of room you're in?
Everybody's in there and they're saying, well, they really don't want us on this record, so here's what we're going to play. And that's kind of the attitude. And, you know, you have three pissed off guys that kind of don't care what they play and really want to make a statement. And
this is Lou Reed and Sterling Marson are the three? Is that?
No, I think it's... And Mo, we're trying to do a track, I think, for Nico. Mm-hmm. Actually, it sounds a lot better than I remembered it. I mean, it's pretty visceral. I mean, we were trying to. There's a lot of anger in it.
Just one more time. Let's just randomly go about 7 minutes further on and just see where we are. Total random.
Where were we there?
We were about 16 minutes, and now we're where?
Whoa.
22.
Now we're 22.
Oh, there's Nico.
Yes. Can you tell where you are in this, and who's on guitar? And
I think wow. Yeah, I must have been playing bass, I guess, or piano. It kind of reminds me of how Sister Ray began. And it's something...
And tell me more.
I think it's just the beginnings of Sister Ray, I think. Mm-hmm. And where it went from there into something more coherent.
Were those sorts of things... My guess is they're not discussed. This is nonverbal communication in the best of ways, where you're all in a room and you all have your noise-making tools.
Yeah.
And you wind up somewhere. And at the end of the night, exhausted. What's the feeling when you do
Well, I mean, some of it was kind of... what the hell, you know, we did a tour, and eventually the tour, we all decided that, okay, we're all going to be experimenting, and first of all, we'll let Mo go out, and she can experiment.
Maureen Tucker,
Mo, yeah, and Mo goes out and starts keeping the beat, and that's it. And then after a while, I go out and I play the viola or the keys or whatever, and then Sterling comes out, and then finally Lou comes out, and we've been playing, by the time Luke comes out, we've been playing for a good 20 minutes. And the place is emptying out slowly. And but, you know, in some cases, some extraordinary things happened. I mean, Lou all of a sudden starts declaiming like a Southern preacher in the middle of this. Huh. Of this, and that's kind of what I remember as being the high point of all those experimental nights, was where this happened, where all of a sudden the persona of the person who's singing changed and then went back into a song and then went straight from this 20-30 minute improvisation into either Sister Ray or into Waiting for the Man or something like that. And then I thought that was exactly what should have happened. But I, you know, when I think back of it, and you see everybody going out one at a time, it's, you know, that's the end of the band you're looking at right there.
Yeah. From the perspective of, like, this happens a lot in music, and you certainly saw it in some of the snottiness that was in music of the late 70s. In one way, the band wants you to hate them, and another way, you want them to love you. Can you dig into that a little for me?
Wait, I'm not sure I understand.
Oh, sure. Well, in this case, the story you describe is that, you know, you're making music that you know is abrasive, you know is...
Yeah.
Right? But at the same time, moments come where all of a sudden magic happens, and you certainly would, I would think, want people to be around to hear where that magic happens.
True, yes.
So that's what I'm saying. You're being snotty in one way and trying to drive people off, and the other way, you're hoping that people hear when the moment comes that you do something.
I don't know. I don't know if it was snotty, you know, really in its essence. It wasn't snotty. It was like saying, we're determined to do this thing. We don't know quite what we're going to do, but we're going to have a shot at it. So you're going to come with us or you're going to leave us, but we're going to try and get there whether you're here or not.
That's awesome.
And that's kind of...
I like the way you put that.
Yeah.
We are about 40... I don't want to make you feel old, but we're 45 years or so past the music you made in that period. Can you see any connect the dots anywhere between the kind of music and adventures you were taking back then and going into the studio alone or just with an engineer here and just banging on things and making things and seeing what happens? It's a
strange one. It's a mental viewpoint that... When I was growing up and trying to be an avant-garde composer, and in the midst of all the cultural upheaval that was going on in Europe about contemporary music and about what do you do as a composer, because this is post-war Europe where everybody's saying, don't ever allow things like the Furtwängler example to happen again, where Furtwängler conducted, you know, this orchestra for Hitler. So from now on, you can no longer write music that really is suitable or can be played for dictators. You've got to think about what social value your music has before you actually write it. I mean, this is like a torturous cultural event for composers. And you have Schoenberg on the one hand. It's the end of the diatonic system as far as composers. You've got Stockhausen, who's now telling you have to plan change into your music. You have to plan what you can't play one note before you've already played the other 12 or the other 11. And there are all these rules that, you know, you have to plan change and never repeat something twice. That's kind of the thing that stuck in my head. And Lamont came along and said...
Lamont, you know, Young, I'm sorry.
Lamont Young came along and said, look, there's change in the music already. All you have to do is sit and listen to it. And you have a drone and you sit there and listen, and you all of a sudden you're hearing overtones and all sorts of things that you never thought were there. So, you know, in my mind, never repeating yourself... and never going back to where you were is really, on the one hand, you can think of it as a cultural fly-by-night, that you know that you're never going to get caught in the same way that Fritz Wrangler was caught or any of the European composers that were caught for performing for dictators or whatever, and the ramifications of really not thinking through what the value of your cultural contribution was. That's a bit heavy, but I mean that's where it all came from. I mean, and Lamont, and really trying to do something different with the VU, and then trying to make songs that are constantly different and evolving. It's that's kind of what's in the engine room.
Why don't you pick us a song to go out on? And thanks for doing this.
You're welcome.
Should we play Midnight Feast?
Yeah.
Awesome. This is from Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood. John Cale, thanks so much for taking time today.
You're welcome.
Pleasure to talk to you.
See you later.
All right. Be well. John Cale's new record is called Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.